Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in Fantasy and Adventure, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. This is your host, Gabrielle Matthew, author of the historical fantasy Falcon series and Girl of Fire, the first in a YA fantasy series. My December interview is with Evan Winter. Orbit released a hardcover of the second book in the Burning series, The Fires of Vengeance, in November. Here's the plot. Desperate to delay an impending attack by the indigenous people of Shida, Tau and his queen craft a dangerous plan. If Tau succeeds, the queen will have the time she needs to assemble her forces and launch an all-out assault on her own capital city, where her sister is being propped up as the true queen of the Omehi. If the city can be taken, if Queen Ciora can reclaim her throne and reunite her people, then the Omehi might have a chance to survive the oncoming onslaught. A little bit about Evan. Born in England, he was raised in Africa near the historical territory of his ancestors. He always wanted to be a writer, but went to university first, tended bars in two different countries, became a director and cinematographer, and eventually became the creative director for one of the world's largest infrastructure companies, all before realizing that the words in his head would never write themselves. So, before he runs out of time, he started writing them down. There's plenty more to read on his website, evanwinter.com, EvanWinter. It has cool graphics, too. His Twitter account is at Evan Winter, and he's on Facebook at EOM Winter. There are two things you won't find out about Evan on his website. His second language after English was Bemba, which is Zambia's most common local language. And he has double-jointed shoulders, and when he was younger, he could skip with his arms. Evan has agreed to do a short reading before the podcast.
Hello, this is Evan Winter, and I'm about to read a short section from Book 2 in the Burning series that began with The Rage of Dragons. So I'm going to read the chapter titled Duma Sibusisu from The Fires of Vengeance. And the short chapter is about Duma, who is from Scale Jayed, champion Solaran's old scale. And Tau Solaran has asked him if he'll join a new and somewhat experimental unit. Here we go. Duma Sibusiso. Duma couldn't be sure if he was lucky or damned. Night had fallen long ago, and he was sitting cross-legged in the dirt behind the building where they housed the horses. It seemed strange that the animals had a better roof over their heads than anything he'd had growing up. But a lot happened around nobles that was strange. And Duma wasn't one to waste thoughts on foolishness he couldn't control. Instead, he wondered if Tau Champion Solaran had become some kind of noble. He certainly looked like he had, sitting across from Duma in that red and black leather armor. Scale Jayed, Duma thought, had changed Tau. Well, it had changed all of them, but him the most. And Duma knew himself well enough to admit that the man Tau had become was a frightening one. Solaran had always had a way of looking at a man like he'd just as quick slit his throat as offer a word. But Duma had known that type back home, and there was usually something you could do to stop them from actually cutting your neck. The thing that made the new champion most frightening was that, as best Duma could tell, there was precious little to be done if Tao got it in his head that someone had spent more than enough time living already. So Duma wasn't sure if he was lucky or damned. But Tao Solarin had come to him that night to ask him to be the sixth man in his new unit. And Duma took pride in that. He looked round at everyone, seeing Uruak, Yaw, Themba, Azima, that pretty lady gifted, and, of course, Tao. Unlike Duma, they'd all done this before, and yet he could still see the anxiousness in their faces. Given what Tao had told him to expect, it made sense. And Duma couldn't say he was looking forward to what they were set to do either. It also made his mouth dry, thinking that he was expected to do something Kellen O'Carr hadn't been able to handle. But the way Duma saw it, if Tao and his sword brothers needed him, he'd do his part.
Well, a big welcome to Evan Winter, and thank you for doing the reading.
Thank you very, very much for having me, Gabrielle. It's a pleasure and an honor to be on the show. Thank you.
Great. So let's talk about your second book, The Fires of Vengeance. In your series, a people called the Omehi are invited by the Shidin. That should be invaded. Tell us about the Omehi. Do they have special abilities? And tell us a bit about their government system.
Yeah, thanks for the question. So the Omehi have come to a new land. They're escaping something that we don't yet completely understand when we're reading book one. And they've landed on this new land, and there are an indigenous people there. And what ends up happening is that the Omehi justify the displacement of that indigenous people in order to save themselves. And they think that they are right and just in doing that, in large part because they consider themselves and call themselves the chosen people of the goddess. Mm. And a large part of what allows them to displace the indigenous people is that they have the ability to control dragons and bring them to their aid. So yes, the Omehi have some pretty awesome magical abilities, and they use them to make sure that they can survive, and they believe that their ability to use these gifts, as they call them, justify their use. Because, you know, why would the goddess grant them these abilities if not to be able to use them? So that's sort of the idea behind the society and how they sort of tend to view the world. And in terms of their government, the Omehi are a matriarchal society that is basically monarchical. So power rests with the queen. The queen gets her power, gets her authority from the divine, from as a matter of divine right, from the goddess. And it's sort of similar to a lot of monarchy that we would know in our own world. And that sort of sets up some part of the internal struggle in the society as well that we sort of explore through book one and into book two.
So the Shidin aren't actually invading the Omehi the way it seems in the beginning of the second book. They're more defending where they used to live.
That's exactly right. And given a sort of big event that happens at the end of the first book, which I, just in case that people haven't read it, I won't spoil, but there's a big event that happens at the end of the first book that prompts the Zadin to take even more aggressive action than they have in the past, which is why they are about to attack sort of in full force the little strip of land that the Omehi have managed to hold on to for generations.
Well, much of your second book continues to focus on the Omehi warrior, Tao. He's a young warrior of common birth, but through lots of training and brave fighting, he transcends his class. And in the second book, he becomes the queen's chosen warrior. Tao says, "We'll burn our pain to ash in the fires of vengeance." Can you elaborate a bit on his feelings and what he's been through?
Yeah, no, thank you for the question. That's a great one. I think that in large part the reason that Tao feels the way he does, that it's an overwhelming sort of rage and frustration. And that stems from the fact that for his entire life, for the entire lives of everybody that he knows that exists in his family, they have had so few options for leading an existence of security, of opportunity, of happiness. Everything can be taken away from them in an instant, or at the whim of anyone from one of the higher classes. The Omehi are a strict caste society, and Tao and his family are belong to some of the lower classes, and their lives are not treated as being of equal value to the lives of the nobles. And so typically what ends up happening for someone like Tao is they live out this very, very subsistence and meager existence until the day that they die, either in war or probably from partial starvation or sickness. He finds a way to become very, very powerful in his society. And so it's the books and the story are an exploration of what happens when someone who was powerless and was always meant to be powerless finally finds some level of power in a world and society that has always sought to grind the group to which he belongs under the heel of their boot.
That's very well put. So a priestess, one of the chosen, tells Tao that the powerless think too simply. She obviously means him. She says, they see things as either right or wrong, but the world and the purpose of those in it are distorted, misjudged, when reduced to so basic a binary. Does Tao experience, on some level, does he experience himself as powerless, even though he's an exceptional warrior?
Yeah, I think that he does. I think that sort of the history and the context of his past holds him to a certain level, even though he has, within the context of the society, managed to rise. So it's also the fact that all the people that he knew growing up, all the people that matter to him typically within his closest circles are people that have not managed to find their path, a path out of the misery that is sort of just the natural state of their lives in the society. So the problem with being a person like Tao is that when there's a societal structure that restricts people from being able to live equally among one another, just because someone like Tao, who is truly exceptional, manages to find a way out of that level of oppression, it doesn't mean that the society is more fair. It doesn't mean that Tao actually has that much power, because everyone he cares about still suffers under that system of oppression. And you shouldn't have to. Part of the point of that, I think, and the way that he feels, is that you shouldn't have to be exceptional to escape, I guess, an awful, awful situation in a society. And it's easy to sort of maybe suggest that, oh, well, look, you can point to Tao in this, within the Omehi society, the nobles can point to Tao and say, things are reasonable, things are fine in the way that we do everything, in the way that we consider meritocracy, because someone like Tao has managed to rise so far. Mm-hmm. But you shouldn't have to lose half your mind to do it. You shouldn't have to suffer what he had to suffer to do it. And that's sort of some of the point, I think, that's happening there from Tao's point of view.
So in Tao's point of view, he has very clear feelings about the roles of dragons in Omehi society as well. Can you talk a little bit about the dragons and why Tao would have strong feelings about the way they're treated?
Yes, that's a tricky question. I'm going to try to answer it without spoiling very much again. Let's see. I'll say this. In the beginning, All the Omehi understand that, or believe, because it's sort of their cultural teachings, that they are the chosen people of the goddess. And as part of that, they have the ability to call down dragons to aid them, and to defend them. They call dragons guardians. And as we go through the story, we start to learn a lot more about the nature of that relationship between the chosen, the Omehi, and their dragons. And it puts Tao in a very interesting position as he starts to understand what is actually going on and why it's going on. And then he also starts to become a bit of a weapon for his society, at least in the eyes of sort of the royalty, the royal class of the monarchy, specifically the queen. And so then he starts to be put in a position where he plays a role very similar to the role that the guardians play. And given what he learns about them and the nature of that relationship, it sort of sets up an interesting series of sort of questions and sort of leads you to wonder about Tao's motivations, the Queen's motivations, and where we end up going from here. At least that's what I hope happens in the story. And those are some of the more exciting and interesting questions for me to explore as I was writing it.
Yeah, so you mentioned the Omei Queen's character, and it's more developed in book two. It seems like even her own ministers don't take her seriously. Is that a mistake on her part?
I think it definitely is a mistake, and because Queen Ciora is someone who very much deserves to be taken seriously, and to do otherwise is to greatly underestimate the type of person that she is. I think that what happens is the people, the other royal nobles, the other greater nobles who end up being the other power brokers in society, see the path that the queen, their young queen, is taking to be counter to their own goals, to be counter to the way that they think the Omehi need to go to maintain their way of life. And so they resist her. And so perhaps they also do understand that she's not necessarily a weak person, but they believe that letting, even though she's their monarch, letting the queen guide them along a path that reduces their own power is something they just are, it's something that's intolerable to them. And I think that's sort of, I think that's not unlike most powerful people and most examples of power that we see even in our world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she's in some ways a figurehead, but Tao, mm-hmm. is he willing to serve her the way that she wishes?
I think that they both, at the start of their relationship, I think that they both seek to, I don't even want to use the word use each other, because I'm not sure that they necessarily see it that way. But I think that they both understand that they have something to gain from the other. And so they're looking to gain that. And again, even given the way that the sort of Iomehi culture is, they're probably both seeing it as an ends justifies the means kind of situation where if they get where they're going, however they end up treating one another, and some to a certain degree, however they end up treating the rest of their society, can be justified. And mm-hmm. that's a dangerous sort of line of thinking to go down, and I think we start to see in The Fires of Vengeance, which is book two, some of the repercussions of that type of thinking.
So your series reflects an African sensibility. Tell us where you lived while you were growing up and how your own ancestral roots are reflected in the story you choose to tell.
Yeah, I grew up in Zambia, which is basically right along the equator in Africa. And I loved growing up there. I mean, I didn't know anything different, but even looking back after having moved several times since, it was a wonderful place to grow up and explore and to just learn who I was as a young person in the world. I think that what I tried to draw into the books, into the story, was an understanding of geography, of landscape, of culture, of people, of language, insofar as the different kinds of sounds that we don't often have to make with our mouths in the West or even see on a page in the West. I felt like it was very important to me to try and bring some of that in, bring the heat of the country into mm-hmm. into the books, bring the sort of the feel of the cloth and the clothing that people wore, the way they spoke to one another. I'm not drawing specifically from the myths or the actual history of Africa or Zambia or the Xhosa who were part of the inspiration for the type of story, but I am trying to draw from my own memories of what it felt like to live in a place that we don't often see in epic fantasy. I grew up reading epic fantasy and adoring the genre. I still do. But I never got to see stories that sort of reflected the world that I knew as I was reading a bunch of these growing up. And so the Razor Dragons and the Burning series is sort of my attempt to take from the genre that I love so much and give a little bit more of who I think I am essentially into that type of story, because I didn't really get the chance to see that very much.
Yeah, you're carrying your own sense memories and creating a world out of that. Mm. I definitely agree. Epic fantasy seems to center around medieval Europe, especially the UK area, perhaps France. So, yeah, it's nice to hear more and more voices from around the globe. Well,
Thank you.
A self-published author, you took the fantasy world by storm in 2019 with your first novel, The Rage of Dragons, which did include a marvelous cover. You've now signed a 4-book deal with Orbit. What in your background might have helped with your success? For example, do you think you invested more financially in your books than the average indie author? Or did you have other knowledge through your prior career choices?
Oh, yeah, that's actually another really good question. And yeah, I think that my background did help. I ran my own sort of very small boutique production, music video production company. And I also worked in sort of have a bit of a marketing background as well. And when I actually first self-published The Rage of Dragons, it was in the fall of 2017. And what was really important to me was I'd done as much reading as I could about sort of the overall publishing industry and where the indie world fit in with that. And I sort of learned that on average, around 2,000 books, new books, are published every single day when you include indie books and in the trade books as well. And with that sort of information, I was kind of thinking to myself, well, how does any one book get any attention? How does that work? When there's 2,000 new books every single day, plus with the digital world, you have permanent access to almost everything from, you know, from the beginning of publishing. And I guess my thinking was that my thinking was that a key part of having readers find your work is visibility. And one of the powers of online and indie book publishing is that there are tools that allow you to advertise and to promote a book that in a way that you can try and find readers who are the ones most likely to enjoy the type of story you're telling. And that was a large part of what I wanted to do. I wanted to say, I'm going to learn some of these online platforms, ad platforms. I'm going to try and figure out how to find readers who would be interested in the story that's being told here, and then hopefully make the book visible to them, and then ideally they'll give it a shot and enjoy it. Good marketing is never, I mean, really good marketing, I would think, is never an attempt to sell somebody something they wouldn't want anyway. It's never an attempt to present, you know, your book, your product, whatever you want to call it, in front of someone who has no interest. That doesn't serve you as the marketer, and it doesn't serve the customer that you're maybe trying to get, because they wouldn't want your thing anyway. And if they were to try it, they'd hate it, maybe. But with online advertising, you can really sort of find people who are interested in the type of thing that you've made. So in terms of, did I spend more than the average indie, or did I focus more on that? I think maybe if you use the word average, it would definitely be true. I did, because it was a large part of my sort of idea about how you even have a chance at all of getting your book to be given a shot. There's an idea that, you know, the best books will rise, you know, or meritocracy will make all the difference. But 2,000 books a day, how do you even get to find out which ones are the best? And who are we talking about when we say the best? Because the best book for a romance reader will not be the best book for a thriller reader, will not be the best book for an epic fantasy reader. So you have to sort of, I think, a little bit create those opportunities. And that's just about making your book visible.
Right. And you also invested, for example, in cover art that made people look twice, which getting a good cover art is an investment as opposed to just downloading a pre-made cover. So it definitely paid off for you.
Oh, thank you.
Well, I've got one last question reflecting back on November, which is when we're recording the interview so that we can get it up for December. It's a comrade of Tao, a quote from Hadith. He asks, at its essence, isn't true leadership simply service? And that question, could that be pertinent to the results of the recent presidential election in the USA?
Yeah, that's a tough one. And I think that I do believe that Hadith is right. Leadership at its essence should be service. Otherwise, one leads for one's own self-aggrandizement or one's own benefit and not for anything else. So true leadership at its heart is service. Is that pertinent to the recent U.S. election? I mean, I think the difficult thing is that in the U.S., there tend to be primarily two sides. There are occasionally third parties and they pull a few votes. But the overall system and the overall rules of the system over generations have sort of pushed towards a two-party system in America. Mm-hmm. So the voters, the 360-odd million people in America, maybe it's up to 400 million now, they have two choices to make. And the funny thing about believing, even if you believe that quote and you want to vote based on that quote, the funny thing is that voters on both sides will believe that they have voted for someone who will do that. They will believe that they have voted for congresspeople, governors, and the president who will do those, and the vice president who will do those things.
That's true. Mm-hmm.
That's also what I think I'm trying to tackle in a lot of the questions that I'm asking in this series and that I'm exploring, is the power of perspective and the difficulty one has in changing another's worldview or their mindset. Even something as inflexible as truth should seem to be ends up being incredibly flexible, because even an attempt to define truth depends on where one stands when one attempts that definition. So Hadith, I think, is right. I personally think so. But the funny thing is, people who cast votes for either party in the previous election would also think Hadith was right, and they would also all think that they had done what Hadith would have suggested.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a matter of perspective, isn't it? Well, what are you working on now?
I'm actually working on book three of the series. It's a four-book series in total. And I'm working on book three right now and, trying to do as much writing and as much careful writing as I can in the very, very weird and odd and difficult kind of horrible year that 2020 has been. And I think a lot of that's actually seeps into the writing. And perhaps, luckily for me, in some weird kind of awful way, the book tries to deal with a lot of the questions I'm asking in the series tend to be heavy and a little bit difficult. Mm-hmm. And so I've been able to mine a lot of what happened in 2020, because 2020 has almost been this weird crucible for humanity. And we've gotten the chance to really observe how people behave en masse when tensions get ratcheted up. And so I hope to put as much of my perspective on truth from what I've observed into the books as possible, right? And even going back to your other question about the election, when I say that there's the perspective, I think this is important for me to say, which is why I'm jumping back. I'm definitely not a sort of a both sides kind of person. It is not that often when both sides have equal access to verifiable or at least equal access to observable facts, to an ethic of decency and humanity and equality. It's not often the case that is so. And although we've sort of come to this place in history where we try very hard to be like, oh, there's two sides to every story, there are two presentations, there are many more presentations to every story, but reasonable sides, there are often far fewer than are presented. So, I need to say that as well.
That's a good point. So personally, looking at the facts, and you've developed some conclusions which aren't necessarily part of the show today. But that's what I hear you saying. Okay, well, thanks so much for making time for us today.
My pleasure entirely. Thank you for making the time as well.
Thanks for joining me today on the New Books Network in Fantasy and Adventure channel. I've been talking to Evan Winter about the second novel in his Burning series, The Fires of Vengeance. I'll kick off the new year with an interview with the writing duo, the couple Gordon and Ilona, who write best-selling urban fantasy with a touch of romance under the name Ilona Andrews. They have fun collaborating, and it comes across in their interview. I'm your host, Gabrielle Matthew, author of the YA fantasy Girl of Fire, the first in the Baroness Quest series. You'll find the podcast schedule on my website, GabrielleMatthew.com. You can also follow me on Twitter to get updates about new podcasts and more. I'm on there at Gabrielle Author. So till next time.